I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Bobby Rydell's first hit song, Kissin' Time, hit the airwaves in the summer of 1959.
They're kissing in Cleveland, Kansas City too. They're wailing in Wildwood, back in Waterloo. They're scooching on love, even in St. Louis. So baby, get ready, I'm kissing you. Oh baby, cause summertime is a kissing time, USA. So treat me right, don't make me fight. The Battle of New Orleans tonight. They're kissing on beaches, the shiny sea, smooching on benches, neath a kissing tree. Lipstick on collar, done in Tennessee. I saw my baby come on now, started kissing me. Oh, oh, cause summertime is a kissing time, USA. I so press your tasty lips to mine, sweeter than wine, and it feels so fine.
Bobby Rydell, born Ritterelli, was one of a number of pop singers from South Philadelphia who were famous in the 1950s and 60s. Frankie Avalon, Eddie Fisher, Fabian, Chubby Checker, James Darren. He went on to record more hit songs, sold 25 million records, and was known for his smooth voice, his charisma on stage, and his well-coiffed pompadour. He starred in the movie Bye Bye Birdie, almost got the part given to Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, and has had a busy career performing. In 1992, he started drinking after learning his wife had breast cancer. He kept his alcoholism hidden for years until it finally caught up with him. Bobby Rydell begins his memoir describing being wheeled into the operating room for a double transplant for a liver and a kidney. He almost didn't make it. The book is Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances, written with guitarist and arranger Alan Slutsky. They both join us on Radio Times to talk about Bobby Rydell's long career. He does still perform. And Bobby Rydell, it's been a couple of decades. Nice to have you back with us on Radio
you.
Times.
It's a pleasure. Thank you ever pleasure. So much. Bonnie.
Yeah, pleasure as well. And Alan Slutsky, thank you for joining us as well.
Good to be back.
Nice to have you back as well. So what was it about South Philly, 1950s, that was the home of so many of these teen idols?
Well, I always used to say that there was a water trough.
You think so?
Yes, on 9th and Dickinson. And if you drank out of it, you became a singer. If you put your feet in it, you became a dancer. If you did both, you were a song and dance man. I don't know why.
But it is interesting, Alan. Why do you think this part of Philly just gave rise to so many of these stars of the 50s and 60s?
Well, first of all, you know, they were a bunch of good-looking kids. I mean, Avalon was, you know, devilishly handsome. Bobby was, you see the cover of the book, Bobby was a killer. Like, whenever I showed a book cover to anybody, they go, oh, my God.
Handsome guy, right?
He was a handsome guy.
You look at that picture on the book and you go, what happened?
We all do that, just so you know.
What happened?
You write about your dad, I guess, buying you your first drum. You had gone to see Gene Krupa play.
My dad was a big band lover, and years ago we had a place in Center City called the Earl Theater. And my dad took me one afternoon to see Benny Goodman and his orchestra, and who was playing drums for Benny Goodman but Gene Krupa. Mm-hmm. And I said to my father, I don't know who that guy is, Daddy, but I want to be him. I want to be that guy playing drums. And I started playing when I was about 5, 6 years old and still play today.
And you still do?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And something you were good at? Were you good at, did it come naturally, or were you one of those kids
really, it came naturally. And I had a drum teacher on Wharton, 16th and Wharton. His name was Sam D'Amico. God rest his soul, he passed away. And I studied with him when I was about, 12, 13 years old. Took lessons, and he said to me, Bobby, I can't teach you anymore. You know, I've taught you everything that I know. If you want to pursue it, you know, you have to go to New York City, study with a guy by the name of Sam Yolano. And I said, you know what? I want to play, man. I'm through reading, quarter notes and 16th notes and eighth notes. I just want to play. So it's always been in me, yeah.
And were you always a singer? I mean, did you always have a good voice?
Well, when my dad was overseas, of course, my mom.
For the war.
Yeah, for the war. My mom and my dad, kept writing back. And my mom would always say, the baby's always singing, the baby's always singing. And my father wrote back, who knows, maybe one day we'll have a star in the family.
Wow.
And I still have that letter today, in my home. Yeah, yeah.
Alan, what do you hear in Bobby Rydell's voice?
Well, Bobby, he had a lot of influences, particularly Sinatra, guys like, Tony Bennett, Johnny Ray, who he heard when he was a young kid. And he was, of all the South Philly singers, the teen idol guys, it's undisputed. I mean, they all knew he was the voice. It's not something they're not competitive about it. They just acknowledge Bobby was the singer. Some like Fabian was the best looking of the three, but Bobby, Bobby had the pipes.
It's funny.
Go ahead, Bob.
You mentioned Fabe, and he has a blurb in the book. And I think he says something to the effect. He said, I tried to sing like Bobby Rydell once, and I was in traction for 2 weeks.
That's right.
Because, and at some point, you did have some trouble with your voice. You sort of had learned to sing wrong, as you write about in this book.
Oh, yeah.
It caught up with you, it
sounds
like.
Not that it didn't do all that much harm, but I was singing on my throat rather than, through the diaphragm. And I studied here in Philadelphia with a guy by the name of Artie Singer, who was a vocal coach. And then years later, in New York City, I studied with a man by the name of Marty Lawrence. And he really corrected me. Mm-hmm. I would say I was about 18, 19 years old. Matter of fact, it was when I was at the Copa. And he straightened me out, and I really learned how to sing properly.
And you were the youngest performer at the Copa?
Yeah, that's what they say, Marty. Yeah, I was 19 years old, the youngest to ever headline the Copacabana. Yeah.
I have a confession to make. I was in the Fabian fan club. I was not in the Bobby Rydell fan club. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. he lived a half a block away from me. We were both on 11th Street. I was 2400. He was 2500. But I never knew him until we got into business because, as you know, Marty, in South Philadelphia, each corner is like a different hang.
Yeah,
you have your own friends at this corner, who has their friends at that corner. So I never really knew Fabe until we met in the business.
Let's talk a little bit about American Bandstand. I'm looking at you, Alan, just because it was here, obviously, in Philadelphia. Just how influential it was for singers, performers like Bobby Rydell, but also I think for young people that said, this was their entree into this very popular music.
Well, it was the greatest marketing tool in the history of records because they were right at 46 and Market at
Arena,
the studio.
Right?
You're right next to the arena.
Yeah.
And, you could see Killer Kowalski, throw somebody over the top rope, and then you could go see Bobby Rydell next door.
You're right.
That's a perfect evening, right?
Yeah, perfect evening.
Don't forget the wrestling midgets, too.
That's right. But he Dick was the fast track to a hit. If Dick liked your record, it was instantly a hit. So Bobby's first couple records for Cameo, he just told him flat out, nah, this ain't got it.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And then finally, they heard Kissin' Time, he said, that's a hit.
Yeah.
And he just made it a hit instantly.
Just because he played it and you performed on American Bandstand.
Well, I always classified Dick as like the Mike Schmidt of DJs. In other words, Dick wanted to know that the record was selling in Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago. In other words, you get three men on base, and then you get Dick Clark to come up to the plate, and then he knocks it over the wall, because every kid across the country from 3:30 to 5 o'clock, every day of the week,
right.
You say, well, my, Dick is playing this new record. I got to go out and buy it. So he was the home run hitter for sure, Marty.
Let me play another song, and this is, I don't know if this is the one, it's certainly been rattling in my head since listening to it a couple of times. This is Volare.
Uh-huh.
This was 1960, so just a year or so after Kissin' Time.
Correct.
What's the story behind Volare?
The story behind Volare was I was in New York City with Bernie Lowe, who was the president of Cameo, and we recorded an album. And we never released the album because the bulk of the album we didn't like. But there were three tunes on the album that came off. One was Sway, one was All Black Magic, and one being Volare. Mm-hmm. And I was just coming off a song called Swingin' School, and we needed something. We didn't have anything that, you know, I went into the studio to record. But he went back, Bernie went back and listened to the date that we did in New York City at RCA Recording Studio. And he listened to Volare, put the girls on, the girls who did the whoa, whoa, and yeah, yeah, which was, you know, my sound. You know, yeah. it was my sound for years. Put it out, and it became the second million seller.
Well, let's give it a listen. This is Volare, Bobby Rydell's 1960 hit. Bobby Rydell singing Volare, and I have to say here in studio he was lip-syncing Volare, knowing those words very, very well.
You know, that's funny. When I did a lot of Red Skelton shows, and the tunes that we did were all pre-recorded, and there was the producer, his name was Cecil Barker, who produced the Red Skelton Hour, and he used to call me the King of the lip syncs, because when we did the show, you had to lip sync to what we had recorded in the studio. The king of the lip syncs.
It's a real skill. You grew up listening to some of this music, Alan, or this song in particular.
Yeah, I was a little young for Kissin' Time, but then the next year, every housewife in my neighborhood, every teenage girl was singing Volare. You heard it all the time. And then I would go down the shore, and I would see those huge billboards for Steel Pier, and, you know, it would say Bobby Rydell singing his new hit, Volare, right, or whatever, and it was everywhere.
And it holds up. I mean, that's what, I mean, just listening to that, it holds up.
Oh, I was just as you were playing it, I'm sitting there, you know, I mean, it swings so hard. It's just a great tune.
Well, that's Alan Slutsky. He's a Grammy Award-winning musician, author, film producer, joining us along with Bobby Rydell, who needs no introduction. We certainly are talking about his musical career, his life here in Philadelphia, grew up in South Philadelphia, and they have written a book about Bobby's life. It's called Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances. More music and conversation after this very short break. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Bobby Rydell about his musical career, his long musical career, his life here in Philadelphia, and Alan Slutsky as well, and again, a Grammy Award-winning musician, author, and film producer. And we've been talking about Bobby Rydell's new memoir, Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bobby, an email from Neil says, please ask the guest to talk about the album Bobby recorded with Chubby Checker. Really liked it when I was a kid. Can you talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure. It was a wonderful album. You know, I was, you know, riding high at the time, and of course Chubby came out with The Twist, which was, you know, a monster. You know, and to this day, people are still twisting. I think Chubby's in the ground somewhere. He's twisted so much. You know? But he's a dear friend, and they decided, the people, the powers that be at Cameo, to put the two of us together. And there's a lot of songs on the album that were, you know, related to Christmas and New Year's, but it wasn't released at that particular time. Songs like Jingle Ball Rock, What Are You Doing, New Year's, and then other things. We did one thing called, and matter of fact, I saw a Paul Schaefer in New York City, and he said, Bobby, he said, I love that tune you did with Chubby called Your Hits.
Oh, wow.
And we both sang, Your Hits, I wish I had your hits. We'd have a long, long line if we combine your hits and mine. It was really a great tune. And the album was a big seller for Cameo, and very proud of it. It was, and Chubby's a sweetheart. He's a nice guy.
Your voice sounds terrific.
Well, for this time in the morning, I think.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, let's talk about his voice, Alan.
Well, one of the things that Bobby has going for him that separates him from a lot of the singers of that era, first of all, his intonation is perfect. You know, you always hear on, like, American Idol, you're pitchy. There was no pitchy with Bobby Rydell. He was dead on. His phrasing, because he was a drummer, his phrasing was far above what most people could do, because he had that. He had such a great natural sense of rhythm from playing drums. And power. He had range. He had power. You know, he could belt out a high note. I mean, there was a reason why Sinatra said he was his favorite of all the young singers. You know,
wow.
That's the ultimate the ultimate commendation you can get.
You know, God rest both their souls. You know, Blue Eyes and Frank Jr. Mm-hmm. And I approached, and I've been friends with for Jr. and also with, you know, with his dad as well. But I said to Frank Jr., I said, thank you, Frank, ever so much, you know, for, you know, saying that, you know, your Bobby is one of my favorite singers. And Sinatra Jr. said, I never said that. I said, yes, you did. I read about it. He says, no. He said, my father said that.
Even, well.
I said, well.
Even better?
Just
even
better. A wee bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's talk about your hair. And you weren't the only one with great hair, or this pompadour that I certainly remember.
Yeah, that's
back in
gone.
The 50s. I know it's gone.
It's all gone. Yes.
What happened to it?
That's what I said. What happened? You know, now I carry. I call him Fred.
Oh, is that right?
I put him in a little box and I take him on the road with me. Yes.
I
wear a hairpiece. Yes, I do. Yes.
But how much work did you have to go through, and how much, what, Brill cream did you have to use to get
no,
this?
No. What was the thing? Not Brill cream. What was the, you know, because I did. I had a lot of hair. What was the thing we used to use?
Spray net
or Aquanet.
Oh, Aquanet.
Remember
right.
Aquanet? And used to spray that in your hair.
Just
and
to get it
you,
to
oh, you could go. You can go through a wind tunnel. It would not move. It wouldn't move.
But it's so you. I know you still perform, but you put on your.
I put on the hairpiece.
Yeah,
my mother always. Why do you tell everybody you wear a hairpiece? I said, well, who cares?
Right.
Who really cares?
Right.
You know.
Well, let's talk about your mother. And I know this was a painful part of your book. It certainly was painful to read about the way she treated you, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And whatever her problems were, and what do you think they were?
Well, I think back then, of course, nobody knew about it, but my mom was definitely bipolar. I mean, everybody thought my mother was the sweetest person to ever walk the face of the earth. But behind closed doors, she became a completely different person. She was evil. I mean, my daughter, Jennifer, she was in a play, and I think this is in the book as well. She was in Oliver, you know, high school, you know, and she had the lead song, and she was wonderful. I mean, she was really, really good. She had nice pipes, you know. She was about 10, 11 years old, you know, not even high school, grade school, you know, they'd put the play, whatever. And she came home. She was so proud of me, too, and she said in the house, I sing just like my daddy. And my mother said, you'll never be what your father was.
Wow.
Your father was making money when he was 10 years old. My God.
And this was to your daughter, her granddaughter.
Her granddaughter, 10, 11 years old. Give me a break, you know.
So what kind of effect, I mean, as you described, I mean, when you were little, she threw you across the room.
Oh, yeah.
Dinner time was just, it sounded like a minor nightmare.
Oh, yeah. I remember sitting at the table, and this is when, God rest her soul, Camille was alive.
This is your first wife.
My first wife, Camille. Yeah. She passed away 2003, like you mentioned, of breast cancer. And I was, my grandmother and my grandfather had passed away, and I loved, my grandmother used to call me Chickadee. How's my Chickadee? You know, and they, of course, they came from the old country. They came from Italy. So I'm sitting at the table, and Camille cooked exactly like my grandmother because she's, you know, she was behind my grandmother all the time. So we were eating, you know, some kind of, I think it was escarole, or in Italian we call it scarole, you know, scarole and beans. And my mother turned to me and she said, "You never loved your grandmother." Well, the soup came out of my mouth, and I jumped up and I started choking my mother.
Wow.
And Camille came over and took me off of her.
Right.
I mean, she was bipolar. I mean, she could be sweet, but on the other side, you just couldn't deal with her.
And yet you lived with her.
Yes.
I mean, when you moved out of the city, you moved your parents and your grandparents for a while.
When we moved, you know, to the suburbs, when we moved to the main line, my mother went ballistic. Because my mother was a proverbial shopper. In South Philadelphia, she got out of the house, opened the door, got the 11th Street car, and went into town to shop. Now we're in Penn Valley.
Yeah.
What did you do to me? You put me on a cross. And I thought I was doing something wonderful for my mom, my dad, and my grandparents. My grandparents loved Penn Valley. They used to say to my mother, "What do you got to South Philadelphia? Look how nice. You got the trees. You got the birds that sing, you know." 3 years. 3 years it took. "Where are we going to get your clothes pressed? Where are we going to get the meats?" You know, she thought we were in Jabip, for crying out loud, you know. And I went into the hospital. I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown because I really thought I did something wonderful for my parents and my grandparents.
But she saw it as something hurtful.
You took her life away. My mom was the proverbial shopper. That's all she did.
And we will not spend the rest of the hour talking about your mom, but one thing that she also did after your father died was she sort of intimated that you were her husband. Did I read that right?
My father's nickname was Ott. Because there was a famous baseball player by the name of Mel Ott, and my dad played a little bit of ball, so his nickname was Ott. And there were times where, you know, she would look at me and she would say, "Ott." Oh. I said, "Mom, Dad passed away. You know, I'm Bobby. I'm Bobby. I'm not your husband. I'm not Ott." Yeah. And you know, after a while, she started losing it. You know.
Was that hard to write about, though, in this book?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But like you said earlier, Marty, I wanted the book, you know, to be brutally honest, very sincere. And, you know, that's the type of person that I am. And I told Alan, if we're going to do this, you know, we got to do it right. There's got to be, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly in this book, you know. And it's brutally honest. It really is. I'm proud of it, matter of fact, though.
Well, let me reintroduce you. That's Bobby Rydell, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, along with Alan Slutsky. And they have written Bobby Rydell's memoir. It's called Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances. We've also been playing music. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Well, let me move on to another hit song that you had.
Okay.
Interestingly, you never had a number one hit song, but you had a bunch of number two hit songs.
A lot of number twos.
Yeah.
Like in Cashbox and Billboard, which were, you know, the record rating magazines at the time, it was always two. But different radio stations across the country, you know, Volati went to one, Wild One went to one, so on and so forth. But never in the major papers.
Interesting. Well, this is a song called Wild One. Do you want to set that up for us?
Wild One was my very first million seller, and we were going, when I say we, Dave Apple, who did most of the arrangements for on all of my records, we're going to do the Dick Clark Saturday Night Beach Nut Show, if you remember that one, Marty. And Dave always had a pipe in his mouth, always carried his guitar. And on the way to New York City to do the Dick Clark Show, Saturday Night Show, he starts singing. He said, when we get back to Philly, Bobby, this is your next record. He started with the pipe in his mouth.
Yeah.
And we go back home and we record Wild One.
Let's give it a listen. Bobby Rydell's hit song from 1960 called Wild One. And we were joking with Alan Slutsky and Bobby Rydell about how tame that song really is when you listen to it now, Alan.
Yeah, but back then, it was you know, if you saw Bobby at Steel Pier and you saw the impact that song had, it was pretty wild. Yeah.
Describe that for us then.
Yeah, well, when he would play Steel Pier, he was a fixture at Steel Pier. You might have been the most performed, you might have
a
record. Yeah, I mean, sometimes he would do as many as 10 shows a day.
And how was that possible? 10 shows a day?
Yeah, because they would, you know, he would only sing like 4 songs.
Right.
You know, you'd have a comedian, you'd have a cartoon, and then they clear the, you know, he'd sing his hits and then clear the house, you know. And usually by the ninth or 10th show, the whole band was smashed in the orchestra pit.
The owner of Steel Pier, his name was George Hammond,
yeah,
and he loved it when it rained.
Oh, everyone came
everybody came into the theater, yeah, absolutely.
But the girls would be just screaming their heads off.
I was just going to say, right.
And, you know, they would be lined up for, you know, he just signed thousands of autographs the weeks he were there, you know, because they would just be lined up.
That was a definite. You had to do that. I mean, after the show was done, there would be a, you know, thousands of kids lined up outside for autographs.
Right.
And as soon as I would get off stage, I'd change, I'd start signing autographs. By the time I, you know, sign a couple of hundred, you know, whatever it may be, boom, I'm back on stage again. Mm-hmm. Then that show ends, and then you would do the same thing for like 9-10 shows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
What's it like to sing when girls are just screaming their heads off?
Oh, it's wonderful. You know, like they say, you know, years ago they used to throw, you know, bras and pennies.
Yeah, did you ever get that?
And room keys. Yeah, I used to get it back then.
Did you?
Now I get Depends.
Don't go there.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's a picture in there of Steel Pier, and he's singing, and there's a cop right next to him on stage because the cop was there to keep people off him, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You have a foreword in this book, Alan, where you talk about shade pullers. These are the performers that go on stage. They're not interested in doing autographs or hanging out with the musicians. You're saying Bobby Rydell was not a shade puller.
Yeah, well, he's a different character. You know, Bobby is a guy from the streets. He's very accessible. He's very easy to approach and ask for an autograph. And he's always been that way because he's just a kid off the South Philly streets. Whereas, you know, we would... You know, I spent 3 decades playing in the showrooms of Atlantic City, and some of the stars are great. You know, some of them are really nice guys, and some of them, they're horror shows. You know, they're nasty. They don't want to be bothered, you know. And he's never been like that.
Yeah. Who did you play with? I mean, with all the various groups and
people? Oh, Pavarotti, Bernadette Peters, Rickles a million times,
wow,
who I love to play for, Michael Feinstein, Chita Rivera. You know, all the different headliners that came in. I'd either be playing the Broadway shows at the Forest and the Academy of Music. Mm-hmm. I play about 50, 60 Broadway
guitar,
shows.
Guitar, right?
Life. Guitar, mandolin, banjo. Or I would be down the shore playing. And, you know, that's how Bobby and I met in 1992.
Yeah, he was marvelous. We went to see the show, The Book of Mormon.
Oh,
which
yeah,
was
I've seen that.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
And I don't know how, there's one tune in the show, how many, I don't know how many things he has to do. It's the scene with the devil.
Oh, Spooky Mormon Hell Dream, it's called.
Oh, you played on that?
I was in the, yeah,
he
I was
in the
guitarist
pit
on the show, yeah.
I heard you then.
Oh, yeah.
That was the one where the devil, this huge devil's up on the stage and Adolf Hitler and Jeffrey Dahmer and Johnny Cochran are,
yes,
dancing around the devil, and I have to do a solo under that while the devil pantomimes it.
He's brilliant. He really is. Alan is brilliant. He's marvelous. And not only a guitar player, but a writer as well. I mean, I'm not talking, well, I'll talk about the book, his book as well, but I mean just music.
Yeah.
Music. He's
yeah,
a wonderful, wonderful arranger.
How did you deal with success? I mean, you had success. You were a young person.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? Once again, the only reason I'm in the business is because of my dad. If I had any talent whatsoever, my dad was the first one to see it. He used to take me around to clubs when I was 7, 8 years old, the CR Club, the 2-4 Club, the BR Club, the Erie Social, and ask the club owners, can my son get up and do a couple impersonations and sing some songs? And, you know, when that happened, you know, and people started applauding, I went, you know, at a very early age,
yeah,
wow, all I have to do is do this and they do that. You know, what a wonderful feeling. So, Marty's just showing me a picture of, remember him, Frank Fontaine?
Crazy Guggenheim imitation.
Well, yeah, but the original character was called John L.C. Savoni. On the Gleason show, it became Crazy Guggenheim, right? So, you know, it wasn't like an overnight kind of thing for me. And I remember one thing that Bernie Lowe always used to say. He used to say, Bobby, he says, remember, you're going to meet the same people going up the ladder as you do coming down. If you happen to be a bad guy on the way down, they'll just give you a shove to get down there a little quicker. That meant a lot.
Absolutely. That's Bobby Rydell, who joins us along with Alan Slutsky. And we're talking about both of their careers, focusing a lot on Bobby Rydell's memoir called Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chicks. Ah! Kicks. Ah! Cats. Ah! Cool. Ah! School. Ah! Yeah, 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 I go a swingin' school.
La, 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 la.
For where the chicks are kicks and the cats are cool.
La, 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 la.
For where we dance the greatest and we dress the latest. Whoa, 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 I go a swingin'.
That's Bobby Rydell's 1960 hit, Swingin' School. And Kevin Griffin, our engineer, said, you know, this stuff really holds up.
Well, thank you very much, Kev. It still sounds good, doesn't it?
It does sound good. A couple of comments here. Great Lungs. Have you ever thought of doing duets with some newer singers like like Tony Bennett does?
Oh, boy, I'd love to do something with Tony. You know, I've admired Tony for quite a while.
And he did something with Lady Gaga recently.
Yes, he did, and it's wonderful. I mean, and Lady Gaga, you know, I mean, she can sing.
Yes.
I mean, she does a tune on that album called Lush Life, which Sinatra wouldn't do because it's very rangy, extremely rangy, and the melody just goes sideways. And she pulled it off. She did a great job. Boy, if that ever happened, you know, I'd pay Tony, you know, to do it. And another guy I like today is Michael Bublé. I think he's really a good singer. I'd like to do something with him.
Do you listen to a lot of different kinds of music today? Or
Basically, when I'm in the car, you know, I'll listen to Seriously Sinatra. You know, I'll listen to 50s on 5, you know, on Sirius, 60s on 6 with Cousin Brucey Morrow.
Yeah,
boy. We go back a long time, Palisades Park in New York City. Oh, wow. Well, actually, New Jersey. But and then I listen to sports talk radio. Got to find out what's happening.
Well, you're a big Philly team.
Oh, yeah, and so is Alan. Oh, yeah, we're both sick over the last four games that the Phillies have played.
We won't go there.
Don't get me started.
Let me talk a little bit, and this is really where your book begins, where you went on a drinking jag for a while.
Yeah.
Your first wife told you she had breast cancer.
Correct.
And you just kind of fell apart.
Yeah, well, you know, 36 years of marriage, and not only was she my wife, she was my best friend. You know, she really was my best friend. And when I lost her, I mean, there was a void that just couldn't be filled. You know, going to bed, you know, and having somebody lay next to you, somebody you laugh with, somebody you cry with, somebody you tell, you know, all your stories to and relate to one another. And that was gone. So when she passed, I started drinking. Yeah. I started drinking to the point where I became a drunk, a total alcoholic. I mean, I would drink so much that I'd hide bottles in my golf bag. I'd hide bottles in the trunk of my car. God forbid half of the bottle was gone in the refrigerator. I have to make a beeline, you know, to the liquor store because God forbid I run out of my friend, which was vodka at the time. And I'm not just talking about having a couple of drinks. I'm talking about having something like 10 to 20 doubles a day.
Wow. Yeah. Starting in the morning?
Sometimes in the morning. Yeah, sometimes in the morning. But basically, a lot would be after shows, you know, so I would be able to get up on stage and, you know, do something. But then it got to the point where the drinking really, you know, finally took over. To the point which, you know, led to the double transplant, the liver and the kidney. And if I didn't get the transplant, that was July 9th of 2012, I would have been dead in 2 weeks.
You were that sick?
Oh, absolutely.
And this is from drinking, basically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I dialysis for 3 months, you know, because my kidney, you know, started failing. I was going into renal failure. And, you know, God bless Jefferson Hospital and a very, very dear man by the name of Dr. Cataldo Doria, who put in my liver. And he told my wife, and he spoke with a little broken, you know, if a Baba didn't get the new liver, he said that maybe 2 weeks it would have been over. So I'm a very lucky guy.
You even describe you remarried, but even hiding your drinking from your second wife.
Yeah, she didn't know anything about it. Linda really didn't know anything about it. You know, I used to, you know, have a couple of, you know, I wouldn't drink in front of her the way, you know, that I drank at home. And now, you know, we have absolutely no liquor in the house whatsoever, you know.
Went cold turkey?
I mean, you know. You know, and the other thing, too, is what I try to do on all of my shows is how important it is to become a donor, you know. Yeah, because a young girl by the name of Julia, who was, you know, my donor, she was only 21 years old, hit by a car, immediately pronounced brain dead, which, matter of fact, is the only way that you can get organs. You have to be pronounced brain dead. So I try and impress upon the people, next time they apply for their new license, become an organ donor because it truly is the gift of life.
Well, I know that you met with her family.
Yes, I did, yeah.
And you also know, I think, a little girl who also got...
Julia's one of her organs. She's here from Philadelphia. At the time, she was 4 years old. Her name is Asaya. And we just did a couple of things together, some interviews and so on and so forth. And she's a sweetheart. She is now 8 years old. And I didn't know. I thought I was the primary, you know, recipient. But Asaya was. And what we did was split Julia's liver. She got 25%. I got 75%, and the liver is the only organ in the body which rejuvenates. It grows, you know. So she's fine right now. She looks wonderful. She's a snappy little girl, I'll tell you. She's a wit, I'll tell you. She is something. I'm lucky. I'm really a lucky guy.
Part of your second chances, right?
Exactly. That's what it says, a tale of second chances. And I guess the man upstairs didn't want me, you know. We'll give you a couple of more years.
Alan, you want to say something?
Well, I got to see the whole thing in a kind of wide panorama, because when I first met Bobby, it was 1992. He was headlining a Dick Clark show called American Bandstand, a musical happening at the Tropicana. And it was a big summer production show. And he used to come down to the dressing room. He'd always hang with the musicians. So he'd come down to our dressing room before the show. And, you know, a couple of the trumpet players had a bottle of vodka. So he would come in. He would just get maybe a little taste before the show. This is before he got really bad. And he was just a partier. You know, once in a while I'd see him at the Sandcastle, which was a lounge in the Trop, and he would tie one on, but it was just in the realm of a guy partying during the summer. And then over the years, you know, things developed, and I played a couple gigs with him just before, he got really bad. And then, of course, I played with him just after, like, when he first came back. So I got to see the whole thing, you know, from in slow motion.
But he was good at hiding it? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, he was stupendous.
Yeah. Well,
he was a virtuoso at it.
I was a Houdini.
It caught up with you, right?
Oh, it sure did. It sure did. Yeah, Marty.
I want to play, actually, we're pulling this from the middle of a duet that you sang with Anne Margaret. This was from Bye Bye Birdie, 1963, and this is a song called One Boy. But let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it.
One day you find out this is what someone who is living just for you.
Middle of One Boy, a duet with our guest, Bobby Rydell, singing with Anne Margaret.
Yeah.
I mean, your voices really go really nicely together.
Thank you very much. You know, I was just in Florida working at a place called The Villages, and I was in the shower, and my cell phone rang. Of course, it couldn't be, but there was a voicemail. So I immediately played the voicemail, and the voice was Anne. But she says, "That's not your real name. Your real name is Ridarelli, or Hugo." And she said, "Bobby, I just read your book. I can't believe everything that you went through. God bless you." Uh-huh. And we talk. We talk a lot, Anne. We talk every couple of months. How you doing? What's happening? So on and so forth. And the last time I was at the airport in Orlando, and I called her, you know, just to say hello. And sure. I said, "Anne, 1963. Why didn't we get married?"
Why didn't
we get married? She had a thing for Presley.
Oh, she did. That's true. Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah.
You almost got the part that Dustin Hoffman got in The Graduate. You came. How close did you come to that?
I really don't. Well, I did a show called Combat with Vic Morrow. And the casting director was a guy by the name of Lynn Stallmaster. And he gave me the script of The Graduate, and I read for Lynn Stallmaster. He immediately went to Mike Nichols, who produced and directed The Graduate, and he said, Bobby Rydell just gave me one heck of a reading. And Mike Nichols went, from what I understand, this is what Lynn told me, he went, yeah, well, no, he's not what I'm looking for.
Oh, wow.
You know, and
that was it?
Two totally different, you know, personalities as far as me and Dustin Hoffman. You know, he was more nerdish, you know, in the movie. And I was, you know.
You were Bobby Rydell.
I was Bobby Rydell, you know, with the pompadour that once was.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So what was it like? What has it been like, Alan, for you to get to know Bobby Rydell by helping him, working with him on this memoir?
Well, I'd played with Bobby dozens of times over the years. Mm-hmm. And this was such a different project for me because when I did Standing in the Shadows of Motown, it was basically an African-American story. I mean, there were some white guys in the Funk Brothers, too. But and here you get into this whole white bread story. But Bobby had a lot of soul, you know, in what he did, and that was what attracted me to it. And over the years, you know, I you just knew when you play with this guy. I mean, all the musicians down Atlantic City that play in the various casinos, this guy has huge popularity and cred with the musicians down there because we know he's got it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stars there's a lot of stars we play behind and, you know, they're just stars, but they're lucky. He wasn't lucky. He had the goods and still has it.
You tell a story in this book about Angelo Bruno, well-known.
Yeah.
He had a name, the something Don, the Gentle Don,
Don.
The Gentle Don in Philadelphia where perhaps intervened a little bit to help you out?
Yeah, you know, and he was the type of man, he was a wonderful man. You know, he never got involved in drugs, narcotics, and things that he got involved in with, like, the cigarette machines, you know, take care of the linen and all of the hotels, you know.
Numbers, maybe.
Numbers and number rackets, so on and so forth. And I was supposed to do a place in Florida called the Americana Hotel. And then all of a sudden a picture came up with Carl Betts and Nancy Kwan to be shot in Australia called That Lady from Peking. You don't see it too much because they play it against Monday Night Football. You know? I called up, I can't remember the guy's name, you know, the producer or the guy who booked me there. And I said, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I said, I got this opportunity to do a picture in Australia, and it could be better for you, better for me if we can, you know, get out of the. No, no, I got you contracted, and you better be here, you know. But you don't understand. I don't care about no picture. I don't know exactly how it happened, but this particular gentleman got a call from Mr. Bruno. And then I went to Australia.
And there you go.
and I remained. Yeah, you know, it's like we're going to make you an offer you can't refuse. You know, it's like one of those numbers, you know.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but I know that you're very popular in Australia.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I have a great fan base here, but Australia, since 1960, I was there 2014. It was my 23rd visit to that marvelous country, and they come out with banners. Bobby, you came back like a boomerang, mate. You know, it's amazing. It's truly amazing. I love Australia.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking with both of you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, Bobby Rydell, our guest, his memoir, Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances, written with Alan Slutsky. And I should say that Alan is working on a new documentary film about Sigma Sound Studios, The Sound of Philadelphia. So that is something, I guess, in the works. Yes.
Hope to see you in a few years about that.
Exactly. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we do want to close things out with another Bobby Rydell hit. This is from 1963, Wildwood Days.
Spring will soon be gone. Summer's coming on.
Wildwood days.
Now they're dreaming of
wildwood days.
Lots of summer love.